Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well.
I absolutely love this because, you know, if you own a home, it can be really hard to maintain. It's hard to find people that can help you for a big project or a small. Well, whether it's in everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality, it can be hard just to know where to start. But now all you need to do is Angie that. And find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish. Or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps, because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
Tools and Weapons is a podcast exploring the promise and the peril of the digital age, hosted by Microsoft's Vice Chair and President Brad Smith. His latest guest is Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though most of us know Bayer for its pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science, with the goal of making sure no one on planet Earth goes hungry. On Tools and Weapons, Brad and Bill discuss how the German company is using artificial intelligence paired with CRISPR technology to increase food production without fertilizers. Their efforts put AI and digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre on a hotter, more crowded planet. The veteran biotech executive also shares his thoughts on how to keep things innovative at a company that's been around since the 1860s. It's the latest conversation in a series that invites listeners to pull up a front row seat to some of the most important developments in technology today. You can find this episode and many more of Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, weirdos. So the episode you're about to listen to is weird in like a different way than usual. For starters, I'm not in it. Thanks for hosting, Eleanor. And more importantly, we're moving, and this was recorded in a temporary space. We promise that this is not our new normal, and the next episode will be especially pleasing to your ears. It is our Halloween spooktacular extravaganza, and we are very excited to share it with you. So, in the meantime, enjoy the weird facts and maybe some weird hissing noises that you might notice. Just think of it as an Easter egg. Okay, bye.
At Popular Science, we report and write dozens of science and tech stories every week. And while a lot of the fun facts we stumble across make it into our articles, there are lots of other weird facts that we just keep around the office. So we figured, why not share those with you? Welcome to The Weirdest Thing I Learned This Week from the editors of Popular Science. I'm Eleanor Cummins.
I'm Sophie Bushwick.
And I'm Jason Letterman.
So as you may have noticed, Rachel is not here. Don't worry, she'll be back next week for a very spooky Halloween episode. But I have commandeered this very strange ship for this week. But I think, you know, we'll follow the same rules as always and get started by teasing our facts and then getting into our really great stories. So Sophie, do you want to start?
Sure. My tease is that Bubble Wrap's inventors intended it to be wallpaper.
Ooh.
Wow.
Pop, pop. Okay.
Pop, pop.
Jason, do you want to share your tease?
Sure. I want to talk about some Civil War soldiers who had wounds that glowed in the dark.
Oh. Oh. Yikes.
Gross.
I'm already into it.
Yeah, definitely.
I would love to talk about a typographical dispute that had a lot of implications leading up to World War II. So we're going to talk about fonts.
Ooh, I do love fonts.
Well, fonts are great, but I kind of think we should start with glowing wounds.
Oh, I totally agree.
Okay.
Take us away, Jason.
All right. So I was looking for some inspiration this week for a fact, and I turned to our Facebook group, which you are all welcome to join. Search for The Weirdest Thing on Facebook, or it's facebook.com/groups/The Weirdest Thing. And I found this post by Derek Roberts and then with some help from Valerie Franek. Let's just dive in from there.
All right.
On April 6th, 1862, the Battle of Shiloh began when Confederate troops launched a surprise attack on Union soldiers led by Major General and future President Ulysses S. Grant. Yeah, you know I'm all about the name dropping. The Southern troops eventually retreated, but not before 3,000 soldiers had died and more than 16,000 soldiers were wounded. It took 2 full days for medics to get to all of the wounded soldiers because there were so many of them. But as they did, the medics noticed something unusual, which was some of these wounds glowed in the dark.
Wait, so the medics are like going out onto the field of battle and retrieving people?
Correct.
Okay, and it's taking them 2 days.
It's taking people are just lying out there. Yes.
Jeez.
In the mud, in the cold. This is in Tennessee in mid-April or early April, so it's still pretty cold there.
Yikes.
And so these wounds came to be known as Angel's Glow, not just because they were glowing, but also because the wounds that did glow healed faster and healed cleaner than those that didn't.
Huh.
This is a mystery that could have gone unsolved forever, but it didn't.
Thank God.
I know. If you're, imagine you were going to say we still don't know, I would be real mad.
And that was the tale. Thank you, Jason.
So in 2001, the 17-year-old Bill Martin was visiting Shiloh and heard about the glowing wounds. And he turned to his mom, Phyllis Martin, who is, she works for the USDA Agricultural Research Service.
Okay.
She's a microbiologist. And he said, could a bacteria have done that? In an interview with AAAS ScienceNet links, I just love this quote. She says, and so being a scientist, of course I said, well, you can do an experiment to find out.
Yeah.
And if that's not the most mom thing to say,
I don't know what it is.
Phyllis, come be our moms. So he did. Bill and his friend John Curtis started studying what the weather conditions were like at the Battle of Shiloh, as well as the soil conditions. And they did some research on the bacteria that Phyllis studied, which is called Photorhabdis luminescens, or P. luminescens, for its friends.
Right.
Hmm.
It's a bacteria that can glow in the dark and develops in the guts of nematodes.
So what you're saying is that Phyllis literally is an expert in like bioluminescence already. So just like perfect storm.
Yes.
Right. She happened to already be studying P. luminescens.
Yes.
Like foremost expert, the battle, and a great teenager.
Correct.
Ready to rumble.
Correct.
Right.
These bacteria, the P. luminescens, when they are puked up by nematodes, they glow blue.
Beautiful.
Yeah. So P. luminescens could have survived in Shiloh based on the soil and weather conditions of the day, which is very exciting. But there's a problem, which is the human body is too warm for P. luminescens to survive. Mm. But if you recall, this is early April in Tennessee. It's very cold. Some of the men were literally on the field for days and hypothermia set in. Mm. And so their bodies cooled enough that the bacteria were able to get into the wounds and to help heal them.
So how exactly do the bacteria help the wounds heal?
Yeah, so P. luminescens is not particularly infectious to humans. So it's not, there are cases and you can get very sick from it, but more than likely if you were infected.
It's neutral.
It's pretty neutral. Your body would flush it out. But because it releases like a chemical cocktail, that's the term that Mental Floss used in this article that I was reading. Again, thank you, Derek, from the Facebook group. They release this chemical cocktail that can kill off its competitors, and that's probably what helped to kill off pathogens within the wound and save these people.
That's so interesting. Mm-hmm. So it was like it was kind of doing more good than harm in this one scenario. And
correct.
It was able to help the people who survive.
And the conditions were perfect to let it do so. Like if it had been a little warmer or the bodies that were left out there had been, put under blankets or something.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's amazing. This reminds me of a case where with the Joplin, Missouri tornado a few years back, people were brutally injured, right? By like falling debris. Their homes were, completely destroyed. And so when they went to the emergency room, the sort of triage protocol is that you're taking care of people with these sort of, severe physical injury first.
Right.
So all these people who came in with like small scratches and stuff like that weren't really like tended to directly because it seemed like such a smaller problem. So it turns out that there was actually this fungus that like lived in soils. And so it didn't ever really interact with humans that often, right? Like you're not dying from it all the time. But because the tornado literally ripped up the soil and turned the world inside out, it was just all throughout the environment and really easily got into people's wounds. And so it went from, like a topical scratch to like a deadly infection.
Like I'm not terrified enough of tornadoes already.
Well, no. Every time I get a scratch, I'm going to be like, this is it. This is the one that kills me.
But I think like similar to like the Angel's Glow, like it was just such an unusual, like a perfect storm, right? Like, the cliche, like it was like an unlikely set of events that could transpire in both cases.
I mean, that seems more likely to me that you'd have a a perfect storm of bad as opposed to good. I feel like often the stories, when you hear wounds and bacteria, the first assumption is, oh, this is a bad thing, as opposed to the Civil War case where it was actually helpful.
Yeah, it probably saved a lot of these soldiers' lives.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
I love that story. I'm shocked that it was heartwarming. It seemed like it was starting off in a much darker
right?
place.
We start off with a bunch of dead Civil War soldiers.
But like the bacteria, it glowed in the dark.
Hey!
And with that, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in a second with another great fact.
Me, more, I am a robot. Listen to Last Week in Tech. Thanks for that introduction, robot. I'm Stan Horacek, one of the hosts of Last Week in Tech, a podcast from the Popular Science Editors, where we take a look back at the week's big technology stories, including everything from new products, social media, and even future tech, yes, like robots. You can listen on iTunes, Google Play Music, SoundCloud, wherever you get podcasts, or if you are a robot, just stick your antenna up in the air and tune into our frequency. Listen, or I will destroy all humans. Thanks, robot. But please do it, because he's not joking.
We are back, and I'm going to be sharing my teased typographical dispute. I was working on a story last week about this idea. It's called Sans Forgetica, and it's this like new font, and the whole premise is that it will help you to remember better because it's actually harder to read. And it sort of got me thinking about like fonts in general, right? Like they're everywhere. But like it's not often that you look at one and can like name it. Like unless you're really into fonts, you don't spend a lot of time like thinking about them actively. So I was like looking through the contentious parts of font history, which do exist. Thank you for asking.
Do they exist?
Yeah, they do exist. And so the one that I came across that I found really fascinating is called the Antiqua Fracture Dispute.
That makes it sound like the defenestration of Prague, like a major historical event.
It is in selfie. My book. Yeah, exactly. Thank you, Jason.
It should be.
So essentially, there are two fonts that look very similar. Antiqua is one that like you would recognize pretty instantaneously. It's a very, kind of like robust and romantic font. You know, it's something that when you look at it, you would immediately think like old book, like very old book.
Okay.
But
so like very flourished?
Yes, exactly. Okay. Like a very, yeah, very fancy, but readable. And that will be important later.
Okay.
Fracture, on the other hand, was much more difficult to sort of read. It was even more dramatic and had a lot of flair. And that was the one that the Germans preferred and that they believed they identified with deeply. And so going back to the 15th and 16th centuries, as Fracture and Antiqua both sort of emerged, the German people would, you know, use Fracture and the rest of Europe would use Antiqua. And that doesn't seem like that big of a deal until the Germans start to become a very like nationalistic country in the early 1800s. So like, you know, a little bit of background, right? Like the Holy Roman Empire dissolves under Napoleon. And Germany is occupied for a time. And sort of from this comes this like very nationalistic culture. And they are in this period where they're trying to say like what it means to be German. Like this is, you know, a very pressing problem at the time. And naturally fonts are a part of that.
Naturally.
And so they say that, you know, well, Fracture, like that font is a part of what it means to be German. Like Antiqua is not only said to be un-German, but it's like very rudely described at the time. Shallow, light, not serious. Whereas Fracture, let me tell you, being a darker and denser, and by the way, more unreadable script, right? They say that it connotes sobriety and the depth of the German people's culture and intelligence.
Because it takes so much more concentration to read it.
Yeah, exactly, right?
But these are very similar. Like, visually, they are similar.
Yeah. Let me pull up a photo. Like, honestly, I will pull up a photo so you guys can see this.
Can we post this on our website?
Oh, yeah. There will definitely be a photo of these on our website for some comparison. So Antiqua's on top and Fracture's on bottom, right?
Oh, God. Fracture is terrible.
So Fracture almost looks
handwritten.
Wait,
and it's also spelled.
And
I thought it was spelled.
Like a font typed.
I thought it was spelled like fracture, like a fractured bone. That's spelled like fractor.
Yeah, fractor.
German.
Yeah. Yes. fracture, like its seriousness really almost does come from its like inaccessibility on some level. Like you really have to be like versed in reading it to get through it, because it is just like, as you're saying, like almost handwritten.
Yeah. Very curvy.
Yeah. And there are like a bunch of different stories about like the origin of fracture. Like at this time, people were really into like the Middle Ages. And so they wanted to believe that it was some like, you know, Gothic kind of script. There are other stories that like it originates with the Holy Roman Emperor commissioning a piece from Albrecht Dürer, the, you know, the wood block carver, who's very like famous in the German Renaissance. You know, but it was just like such this point of pride. And that continued into the 1930s and 1940s when it became the official font of the Nazi party.
Of course it did.
And that's why I say, like, you know, like, fracture, like, Antigua sort of just blends into the background, but fracture is, like, something when you look at it, you're like, oh, like, I've seen that before. And that is because, like, it was the thing that they were using on all of their propaganda.
So the Nazis are like, what's the most annoying, terrible font we can choose? I know.
Yeah. And they were just like, this is part of like what it means to project Germanness. And so what I think was really fascinating is there was this Vox video that was talking about the font Futura, which I feel like you've seen this, right,
Jason? Yes, I have seen that video.
Futura was something that in the 1920s and 30s, this German typographer was like working on developing, and he was really passionate about it. And he thought that, you know, he could create a very simple script. Like Futura is actually on my like Popeye water bottle, right? Like we use it a lot because it's been to the moon. Like, you know, it's like NASA uses it. It's something that persists to this day in a way that Fraktur does not. He developed this, and the Nazi party just like totally rebuffed like his font and him, and hated him for trying to do something different, which ended up saving the font, right? Because the downfall of the Nazi party means the downfall of Fraktur. But Futura, because it was rejected by the German state, ended up being used everywhere else. And so now, you know, you see that in like Wes Anderson movies and Stanley Kubrick films and all of this. So I just think it's like so funny to think about these, you know, like we're still using Futura every day. And not only does it have its own backstory, but its backstory has a backstory in the form of these like very difficult to read fonts. So that was the thing that really excited me, but it doesn't stop, you know, 70 years ago. Like fonts continue to be like very like politically relevant in terms of, you know, like shaping messages and trying to define like who you are to the world. But also I found this really like interesting case that I just have to share with you guys of a font, a typographical dispute in a legal situation. So it was called Fontgate.
Of course it was.
And at the Fontgate Hotel.
This was literally last year. A Pakistani politician had been accused of sort of like breaking all of these laws, and, you know, like it was a huge scandal. And she put up a bunch of documents in her defense that she says are from 2006 and are like an out, right, to like these like claims against her. But it turns out that the font that these like documents are in, this cracks me up, were Microsoft's Calibri font, which only came out in 2007.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I saw it coming and I was so excited.
She was caught because she tried to use a more modern font.
Yes.
Wow.
Incredible.
So, okay. Also just like
use Times New Roman.
I know. Just go. Yeah. Stick to the basics.
Yeah.
But yeah,
she could have used Fraktur.
Everyone would have been like totally reasonable, but it was just amazing to me. Like, first of all, like who on the like prosecution's like legal team is like their font expert. And like second, like how do I get that job? Like amazing. Like to just come through in the final hour and be like, I know how we like trap this person. Like we have the proof here in this font.
What I wonder if someone was just as a hobby was a huge font nerd and was just sort of like, hey, I don't believe.
Yeah, entirely possible.
What a great legal strategy. Like this, I'm
genius.
Bravo. Yeah, I have no words for how great that is.
Yeah. But yeah, at Popsy, like we've written a lot about different fonts. Like there's like the Sans Forgetica one, which is almost like Fraktur, I feel like, in the sense that, you know, the Germans probably really were smart and did remember a lot of what they were reading because it was so hard to read anything. And so that's sort of what the Sans Forgetica font is doing. You know, but we've also written like about the design of like the Space Force logos, and, you know, the fonts there were criticized. Everyone loves to like yell at the water cooler about Comic Sans. Like, I don't know. I'm just here, I guess, to say that we should all all think a little bit more deeply about our fonts because they have some pretty fun stories waiting for us.
Fonts used to be more fun. I feel like when I was younger, we would play around with like putting the words into wingdings.
Oh, yeah.
Like, ha, 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 now you can't read it.
Yeah. Speaking of which, I spent a lot of time this week watching that SNL skit with Ryan Gosling, the papyrus one.
Oh, my God. I love that sketch so much.
Which is literally about this character's belief that James Cameron, when making the movie Avatar, just like put Avatar title at the top of a Word document, then pulled down the drop menu, went through all of them, and then clicked on papyrus. And that's how we got the Avatar movie logo.
It's futuristic?
Yeah, she goes, in this skit, he hits a fire hydrant, sets off a plume of water, and this woman comes running around and goes, what happened? And he goes, do you remember the Avatar logo? Because it's like 10 years after the movie came out. And she goes, yeah, it's tribal, but futuristic. And everyone's asking him, his friend's like, man, you've already told me this theory. Because he has like a serial killer board of like all of his proof. Where else do you even see this font? And he's like, hookah bars, Shakira merch, off-brand tees.
The way he says off-brand tees is actually like really funny.
Anyway, you should definitely watch the papyrus skit. So with that, we will take a break and come back with some bubble wrap. Can't wait.
Hey pals, looking for super cool popular science merch? We've got you covered at popsci.threadless.com. Pick up t-shirts, notebooks, and mugs with iconic vintage covers and illustrations ripped from the magazine. Plus, check out our podcast store and rep your favorite shows like Last Week in Tech and The Weirdest Thing I Learned This Week. That's popsci.threadless.com. popsci.threadless.com.
We are back, and Sophie, I'm super excited for your story.
So I would like, before I give my story, to tell you both to look under your chairs. And by under your chairs, I mean on your desk, because I brought you bubble wrap.
Oh my God, bubble it's like wrap? An Oprah episode.
This is the worst ASMR video.
So the story of bubble wrap starts in 1957, and this is just a couple years before season one of Mad Men, so that'll help you set the scene, because the trend, this is about like trends in wallpaper, and so 10 years earlier they'd introduced vinyl wallpaper, and you don't just have to have paper wallpapers anymore, so people are trying to make wallpapers out of stuff like bamboo. And these two engineers in New Jersey were like, we should make plastic wallpaper. And not only that, but we should make 3D plastic wallpaper. Oh. Okay, so these two guys, Alfred Fielding and Mark Chavan, Chavannes, I have no idea how you say his name.
That was not what I expected.
Yeah, no.
Chavannes. Mark Chavannes.
Chavannes.
It's almost definitely French because his first name is Mark with a C.
Oh.
Chavannes.
Chavon.
That's it.
So they decided to make this this material, this sort of three-dimensional plastic, by sealing two shower curtains together with air trap between them. And after a few iterations of this, they ended up creating a machine to do so. And I'll talk a little bit more about how the machine to make bubble wrap works later, but for now they were really trying to sell this wallpaper, and it just did not take off. Turns out people don't really want bubble wrap on their walls.
I mean, disagree.
So when that didn't take off, they turned to the next logical application, which was greenhouses. They thought it could work as greenhouse insulation, and actually it did work, but it didn't really take off. So in 1960, the two men founded the Sealed Air Corporation. And then it was after that that they realized they could use this stuff as a packing material. Mm. And their very first client was IBM.
Oh, good client.
Yeah. At the time, IBM had just released one of the first mass-produced business computers called the 1401. And when I say computer, this is not like your desktop PC. This is like
a building.
Yeah. This is a big this is like the computer in Hidden Figures, where you see them learning how to use this giant computer. Or honestly, even to go back to Mad Men, they have a computer in that show too. But this is a really large thing, and it's not
Steve Jobs' computer.
It's like punch cards.
This is a big old computer, and so it's got a lot of persnickety parts in it. And so when you're shipping all these many parts for this giant machine, you have to have a way to protect them in transit. And so the Sealed Air Corporation pitched bubble wrap as a way of protecting it, and IBM accepted, and it really took off from there.
The Sealed Air Corporation is the most, like, late capitalist, like, business name I've ever heard. I love it.
Well, the thing is, the Sealed Air Corporation actually has, like, multiple times through their history considered changing their name to, like, the Bubble Wrap Company, or just, you know, naming themselves after Bubble Wrap. But the thing is, Bubble Wrap is like 10% of their total revenue these days.
Whoa.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
They actually make most of their money from food packaging. So they do stuff like shrink wrap bags and laminated films.
Oh. That's really interesting.
Smart.
Mm-hmm. In 1993, Fielding and Chavon were inducted into the New Jersey Inventors Hall of Fame. And bubble wrap has remained popular ever since. Everyone really loves popping it. Sealed Air Corporation has done a bunch of stunts to keep the name alive. So in 2000, they had a pumpkin dropping contest, and they put a bunch of layers of bubble wrap on the ground, and then they dropped an 815-pound pumpkin nicknamed Gourdzilla.
Oh no.
They dumped it.
I love it.
See, the problem is they dropped this from like a 35-foot crane, and the bubble wrap protected the ground, but then the pumpkin bounced.
Oh no.
Bubble wrap trampoline.
A bubble wrap trampoline would be super fun.
Gourdzilla, yeah. No!
And other kind of cool things about bubble wrap. If you took the annual production of bubble wrap and put it in a line, you could circle the equator 10 times.
That's alarming.
That's a lot of bubble wrap.
And, I mean, one of the reasons I got interested in this topic is because we're actually moving at the office. So we've got a big box of bubble wrap. We're wrapping a lot of things. And I found a video of showing how bubble wrap is made by machine, which is just, it's one of those hypnotic videos, because I think just watching anything be made on large specialized machines is really fun. But the way you make bubble wrap is you start with these pellets of resin, like the size of gravel, and they go into an extruder, which is this long cylinder that rotates while it heats, and you get this liquid from the pellets that melt. And then they squeeze it out of the cylinder into two stacks of this clear plastic. And then one layer gets wrapped around a drum with these holes punched in it. And then they apply suction to the holes to pull the plastic into them to create the bubbles.
Oh.
Uh-huh. And then the other piece gets placed, seals air into the bubbles so they stick together. And then they, you know, dry it and pack it. And the problem is that the plastic the bubble wrap is made of would normally just leak air. Mm-hmm. So by the time it arrived, you just have two kind of squashy layers of plastic without the air between them that acts as cushioning. So a lot of companies used to just sort of spray the outside with a Saran coating. These days, Sealed Air has a method of putting air retention into the material, into the polyethylene during extrusion, but they won't tell anyone how they do it because
naturally,
trade secrets.
There you go.
So my final thing is that this video was addictive, and so I was watching it like multiple times.
I can't wait to watch.
And then yeah. I was reading about it. It turns out that the Sealed Air Corporation releases this video in like 2014. According to them, it wasn't really intended for public consumption. So they there's an article in the Huffington Post where they talked to the Sealed Air Corporation, and apparently a 12-year-old girl named Naomi, who has leukemia, wrote to the Sealed Air Corporation asking, A, how do you make this material? And B, can you send me a big box of it that's in a cool color? And so they created this video for her and sent it to her on a DVD with this big box of bubble wrap.
Hmm.
Aww.
Yeah.
I love that that's what she really wanted to know.
Well, honestly, I don't blame her. I mean, bubble wrap is really fun to pop.
Yeah, I think that she sounds truly great. Jason. All right, let's do it.
Let's go.
I guess it's time to decide who we think had the weirdest fact this week.
Glowing moons. Glowing moons.
I think bubble wrap.
Hmm.
I also think bubble wrap.
Yeah, bubble wrap is amazing.
Yeah.
Yay! Triumphant popping! I'm so sorry to all the listeners.
That's okay. Triumphant bubble popping is exactly right. Thanks so much for listening to The Weirdest Thing I Learned This Week. Stay tuned because 1 week from today, we will have our very special spooky Halloween episode, which is basically our show's Christmas. So it's going to be lit.
The Nightmare Before Christmas.
Exactly. The Weirdest Thing I Learned This Week is a Popular Science podcast. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, Spotify, or wherever you're listening now. And if you like what you hear, please rate and review us on iTunes. It helps other weirdos find the show. You can buy our merch, including Weirdest Thing t-shirts, tote bags, and mugs at popsy.threadless.com. The show is produced by all of our hosts and our editor, Jason Letterman. Our theme music is by Billy Cadden. If you have questions, suggestions, or weird stories to share, tweet us at weirdest_thing. Thanks for listening, weirdos.
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well.
I absolutely love this because, you know, if you own a home, it can be really hard to maintain. It's hard to find people that can help you for a big project or a small. Well, whether it's in everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality, it can be hard just to know where to start. But now all you need to do is Angie that. And find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish. Or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps, because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
Hello, it is your partner, Big Boy, interested in giving back to your community while making new connections in your neighborhood. Introducing Neighbor to Neighbor, a California volunteers network that empowers you to take action, contribute to local needs, and be a part of something bigger than yourself. Visit CANeighbors.com to learn more about how you can get to know your neighbor and strengthen your community. Neighbor to Neighbor, it takes a neighborhood. Hello.